Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Nourish and Flourish, a handcrafted, independent publication taking readers on a journey from the soil to the stars. Subscribe today at nourishandflourish.site.
This week on Meet and Three, we're ringing in the start of our fifth season with dispatches from Portland, Oregon's biggest food festival, Feast Portland. We're bringing you words of wisdom on launching a food business from food blogs.
Most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit very quickly afterwards.
To ice cream shops.
Every city you go to, the Salt and Straw is completely different than any other city.
We'll bring you insights and anecdotes about the business of the business.
We were like, cool, we're going to do this. We're going to try to raise $75,000 and we'll see what happens. And it was like the most gut-wrenching, miserable month.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from, I don't know, actually pretty damn close this time. I was here at noon. Yeah, we didn't start at noon, but I was here at noon. So we're getting better and better, people. From Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Nastasia?
Good.
You doing all right?
Mm-hmm.
Got Matthew in the booth. How you doing?
Feeling great.
So Nastasia is not wearing headphones this week. We could talk more about last week's conversation about zero tasking, because we had someone write in who is a supporter of Nastasia, initially a supporter of me, supporter of Nastasia, if we have time later in the show. But I doubt we will, because we've got an insane number of people with very interesting and different skills here at the program today. So I'm just going to go through who we have. Pick up your phones, call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. First of all, we have longtime friend. He haven't been a guest as often as I'd like. Harold McGee, the grand master of science as it relates to the practice of delicious things in the kitchen. Sitting next to Harold, we have Ed Cornell, the maestro of Milk Cult in D.C. Fabulous ice cream joint, which I have not visited live, but you have sent me the ice cream. How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Then to my immediate right, we have Ariel Johnson, the chief science officer of Good Eats. What are you, a professor at MIT? What the hell are you?
No, I'm an independent scholar.
Ooh, independent scholar.
I was a fellow at MIT for a while.
Fellow. And, you know, the NOMA, fermentation, it's just, the volatile characteristics of bitters, and boozes as they're put through a GCMS with a sniffing thing. I mean, it's whatever you want to know about that kind of crap. Ariel's a good person.
I try to know all the things that you can know about flavor and chemistry and cooking.
There you go. Hey, you know what? It's too bad that you guys agree so often, because since Harold is just finishing a book on a similar subject, like a cage match would have been awesome. But I've never seen you guys.
It would be, I guess, like good press fodder if someone could be like the dueling books about flavor. But I'm amazed by it, and I wish I'd. You know, I'm embarrassed. I haven't written something as good.
Yeah, Nastasia and I once met the guy who wrote Dueling Banjos.
Wow.
And remember when we met him? Brinkman. Remember Sophie's dad? He, among other things, wrote Dueling Banjos. And now I'm imagining, you know, bing, 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 while you guys are like fighting it out. Bing, 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 bing. I mean, like, as I said many times, like, he's done many things. He's one of those EGOT weasels.
Oh, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar.
Yeah, and most of those are like huge cheats. They're just cheating. They're like, because like they write some freaking song that wins a Tony because it's in a freaking play. Then that play is made into a freaking movie, and then they win an Oscar and they win a Grammy for the same song. I mean, and then if they put that sucker on TV, there's the Emmy. I mean, you did one freaking thing and you get four freaky become an EGOT? Ridiculous. Like, people who do it in all different things, like, I believe he won one in all different things, four different works.
That is actually impressive, then.
Yeah, yeah.
But you might have to take that back if they make Hustle and Flow the musical, and that way Triple Six Mafia can be on their way to an EGOT.
Is that what they win their what movie was it that they won the Oscar for the best song?
Hustle and Flow. If they make the new musical, then.
Well, I mean, honestly.
But then they'd have to do a television broadcast of the musical to also win the Emmy.
I mean, my favorite. Oh,
did you guys see like the Jesus Christ Superstar live?
I did not. Nastasia is an enjoyer, a consumer of live television. I am not. But she wanted me to watch it. I forget why I didn't, because I'm constantly singing small riffs from Jesus Christ Superstar. Right, Nastasia?
Apparently, oh no, I can't remember. There's a classical composer that's like a big fan of Jesus Christ Superstar.
As we all know from someone that Nastasia met many years ago, you cannot trust the musical tastes of classical music. Even virtuosos have bad taste in pop music. Right, Nastasia? Yes. And lastly, but certainly not leastly, we have David Karp, the fruit. Now, you go fruit detective?
I'm a scientist specializing in fruit, journalist, and grower.
Now, we mentioned you on last week's program for those people who tuned in, because we met you in Los Angeles at the Houdini party and at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And we talked about Barhi dates last week. And I also mentioned something I thought was interesting, is that you are the rare lover of both temperate and tropical fruits. You never see that.
I think there are a lot of people that love mangoes and apples, at least certainly at the Santa Monica Farmers Market where I sell and write from. There are a lot of people who like both.
Oh, yeah?
Tastes vary. I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the case. There are people who love lychees and who love grapes.
Yeah. I don't know, man. All I'm saying is that whenever I go to visit, like, okay, so here are the places I've visited. The one in-betweeners are like the citrus people. And you hang out with the citrus people because you've done a lot of work with the citrus people trying to... Oh, by the way, before we start, I'll finish this and then we'll start. So it's like... When I visited Geneva, they didn't care about fruit. Phil Forsline, maybe a little bit. That's where we keep... That's the Noah's Ark of apples in the United States. When I visited the Brogdale, which is the, you know, DEFRA's Noah's Ark of apples in England, in Kent, Nastasia and I visited once, Harold and I visited once, didn't care anything about the fruit. The various vigor of the trees was important, but not the fruit. They didn't care about it, and neither did they care about tropical fruit. Ditto most... I mean, like, whenever I deal with especially apple, pear, and small fruit people, they're just grooving on the freaking plants. And you yourself told me yesterday, David, that the freaking Noah's Ark of small fruits in the United States in Corvallis in Oregon, right, which should be the very freaking pinnacle of temperate fruit pomology in terms of deliciousness, they don't even grow them so they fruit. They put them in a greenhouse. They don't even fruit. They keep them in little pots. It's the most pathetic thing I heard. I almost cried yesterday when you told me this.
Well, those are just the strawberries that I was talking about. They do have pear trees, medlar trees.
But how do you stop a pear from fruiting? I mean, that's the thing.
Pear trees are outside and they do fruit.
Well, I mean...
The strawberries are grown indoors and they don't.
And do most of those people groove on the pears or are they sitting there...
Oh, they do. Very much so.
Really? Yeah. All right.
They are real connoisseurs after a fashion. You got to get to know them.
You visit a tropical fruit place and they go completely bonkers for the fruit. They're all about the fruit. You know, what's his name? Campbell at the Fairchild. Fruit all day. The guy just talks about fruit. I didn't hear him say one thing about a tree. Not one. I didn't hear him say anything about leaves, vigor. He was like... This fruit, best. All he cared about was fruit. I think the trees are secondary to him. This is my kind of mental breakdown of like the maybe only a dozen or so. You're the only person I know, I've met, who cares about like kind of the whole, like the kind of broad spectrum of fruits in a deep way. How about that?
Well, there's a reason for that. There are wine writers who care about a broad range of wine, but there are very few people who have written about fruit professionally for their career, like... Really, just me for the general public interpreting it. Why is that? There are no ads, or when there were ads in newspaper food sections, There were very rarely that many ads specifically from farmers or from producers. And I guess the editors figured there was no reason why people would want to know about fruit, so nobody specialized in it.
Huh.
And not enough fruit service journalism.
Oh. Or you have to write a racy fruit stone fruit novel like The Orchid Thief of Fruit.
Huh. It's been done. Look at and right here, as you would expect in Brooklyn, track down The Lemon about a man's obsession with that very fruit.
Why would someone write a book about growing lemons from Brooklyn? Is it just like the unattainable? I mean, this is not like
it's about a man who fell in love with a lemon and not in a platonic sense.
I've seen some racy lemons in my time. Remember the lemon we found, Estasi?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, real racy.
I bet you did.
Yeah. I've seen little boy lemons and little girl lemons. I've seen all the raciness of lemons. But why? So what size is this lemon? Is this a Kafka-esque kind of a situation? Or is it a normal-sized or like relatively large Eureka lemon?
I think it's a normal-sized lemon.
Yeah. Well, you're from California. What's a normal-sized lemon to you? Like, show me your hands. Okay.
No, it's... All right. Like they range from this size to like this size, but when you get that big, if you're a farmer, you're losing money because the market doesn't want something that's so freaking huge. That's like the size of a small football. That's like the size of, I don't know, a large plum to a small navel orange.
All right. And by the way, anyone listening right now who wants to go in on the chat room, David is looking for a good old-fashioned citron market. I said that my old neighborhood in the Lower East Side used to be around Sukkot time, used to be like Citron Central. Like there would literally be tables set out on the street with all the various wares and various different kind of qualities and prices of unblemishedness. But no longer. My neighborhood is now merely a shell of its former Orthodox self, and so you'd have to like go somewhere. So if someone can give us a good location before the show's over, I'd appreciate it. Now, one thing I'm going to have you do before I go into general questions. The people who listen to this podcast are the kind of people that are going to smuggle seeds, fruit, spices into this country illegally, because that's just the kind of people that listen. So give them your pitch for how detrimental that can be.
Don't do it. That is responsible for billions of dollars worth of damage a year and an increased load of pesticides on our environment as farmers deal with invasive, introduced pests and diseases that it's not just a threat to the farmers, it's a threat to anybody that eats. I guess that's everybody, right? Who produces, farmers produce grain, fruits, vegetables. Epidemiologists tell me that it's increasingly looking like every possible disease from around the world that could exist in a given growing area in the United States soon will exist, which is the ultimate nightmare for farmers and for anybody that wants to eat good, clean, reasonably priced food. Why? Because it's a huge economic burden. It's a huge medical burden on the population of the United States to have to spray, to have to spend time and money exterminating pests that were brought in just so casually because somebody thinks that, oh, I won't hurt anybody. You can't necessarily see that tiny little bug, that little mite that might be the vector of a deadly disease that you don't even know about. Don't do it. And if not for that reason, because if you get caught doing it, people do get put in jail and fined big time.
So one of those things, greening is an imported disease, right, or no?
Yes, it's a bacterial disease affecting citrus that's been responsible for the devastation of the citrus crop in Florida, off 75% in the last 15 years.
Shouldn't they have picked a scarier name? I mean, greening sounds like...
Wan Lung Bing, yellow dragon disease. Is that scary enough for you?
Yeah, baby!
That's
the
official name.
Now I don't want it. Give me that one again.
Wan Lung Bing, HLB for short.
I hate that. I don't want any of that in my citrus. Yeah. But does it actually kill the tree or does it just reduce the marketability of the fruit?
Both. It certainly does kill the tree.
Yeah. All right. All right. So should we answer some questions, Nastasia? Mm-hmm. Any questions for our panel, Matt?
Not as of yet, nor do you have a market recommendation.
People, you're disappointing me. Okay, Alex Cole writes in. He's an MD candidate at the UM Miller School of Medicine. He'd like you to know. Horse conch. You guys ever eat horse conch? Are you familiar with conch?
Yes.
All right. You lived in the Northeast for a while, Harold. You ever, in Massachusetts, in fact, you ever go out there to the Cape and forage for whelks?
No.
I didn't. I did have many, many times. So this is just a much bigger variety. What about you, Ariel? Are you a whelk and or conch person?
I'll eat them, but I haven't had the pleasure of foraging for them.
You don't strike me, because if you don't like scallops, you're not like a conch person to stuff. So what about you, Ed? Conchs?
No on conchs.
Good word, though, right? Conch. Anyway, so when you say conch, there are a wide variety of actually not even the same, not just this, not the same species, not the same genus of gastropod, foot stomach things that go around. Now, what you were asked, I should read the question first. Thanks for your time and effort in producing my favorite podcast. Well, thanks for listening. I'm glad somebody does. You have a great sense of humor and unique knowledge. This is my first time writing, and I have a few questions. I've caught and cleaned some giant horse conch, the bright orange type, from Key Biscayne, Florida. I was wondering if you think this is safe to eat. Yes. How can I determine what is safe to catch and eat as I explore the waters in Miami? Do you have any cooking recommendations for this conch? I am an enthusiastic home cook with access to a basic kitchen, grill, smoker, immersion circulator, dehydrator, and a pressure cooker. All right. So first of all, before I go any further, the best kind of and safest, i.e. conservative reference that you can get is, it's on the internets. Fish and Fishery Products, Hazards and Control Guidance, 4th edition, August 2019, from FDA.gov. And if you search horse conch or conch in general, they list like two genuses of conch varieties that are eaten and kind of what might be wrong with them. So the biggest problem that you're going to get from one, which you're not going to get where you come from, is paralytic shellfish poisoning, but that's... You would know if the water that you went in and harvested your conch from, because you're harvesting them, if there was a high concentration of that stuff in the water. So it's not going to be a problem. I was not able to find any, like, parasites, even though the horse conch, unlike the queen conch, which is, like, the one that's being overfished right now and, like, is, you know, it's problematic because of over-harvesting, but delicious and people love it. Even... that one is an herbivore from my research, and the one you eats animals. It's a carnivorous thing. But even so, I wasn't able to find like Anisakis worm references or anything. I wasn't able to find any sort of parasite reference to it whatsoever. So usually in something like that, either it's going to straight out poison you, right? Or it's going to have some sort of a parasite. Now, parasites are usually frozen out. Now, I looked at a couple people's preparation for it, including Miss Florida 2014 or something like that. She has a blog on cooking things, including conch, horse conch. And she, what she does, which doesn't strike me, I mean, I get why she's doing it, right? Is she puts the whole damn thing in a plastic bag in the freezer, right? And then for like 2-3 days. Now this, to me, there's two things you're doing here. You're killing it like the modernist cuisine folks do with their oysters, killing it. And then freezing it through is going to be an antiparasitic treatment. Right? Because that's the anti-parasitic treatment par excellence, you know, for pork and whatnot. Then she keeps it in the bag and thaws it in, like, water in the sink, but because the conch is so big...
She's Gulf Coast, USA.
Oh, so you're not even Florida. Listen, the Gulf Coast is more than just Florida, though. There's more than just Florida in the Gulf Coast. So, like, that includes what? Louisiana? Alabama?
Mississippi?
Texas.
Part of Texas.
Yeah, so, I mean... What's more impressive, Miss Florida or Miss Gulf Coast? I mean, if you were impressed by such things, what would be more impressive?
Gulf Coast.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So then she thaws it for like hours and hours because it's so damn big. And then, of course, it pops out because it's dead. Oh, she has a nifty trick, though, which I think you could use no matter what. She drills a hole in the top section, in the third spiral up. Because that's the air section where the thing is, and she says her words, and apparently everyone else is on the internet because I did Google it, right? Release the suction, so you could get the conch out in one piece. Then you clean off all of the gut, the kind of slimy gut parts. You cut off the is it still called an operculum on that thing, Harold?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the tough foot part, then you skin it like you would a freaking a gooey duck, right? And then you got the nice meat, which you slice thin, and then apparently everyone serves ceviche style in a salad for conch salad. That's the thing. I have seen other people where they do the light boil, like I would do for a gooey duck, a very light kill boil that will also loosen the skin and make it easier to peel. That's what I do on the gooey duck. Maybe I'm just a weasel. I don't know. And then I saw this other guy who's like, yeah, I just break the shell with the back of a cleaver. So he covers it with a towel, and he hits it. He goes, what I'm doing is I'm going around the hemisphere of the top, going clack, clack, clack. You can see this guy on the internet. It's clack, 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 breaking it, and it gets it apart. Then he, like, twists the unfrozen, which I think is going to be better in this case. Although freezing will tenderize. Conch is a tough meat, and freezing it and actually will tenderize it. And the best way to tenderize something through freeze thawing is to create large crystals. And the best way to create large crystals is to freeze slowly and thaw slowly. However, you'll get a lot of what is called in the trade drip loss. And I also don't know how many kind of, as long as it stays around zero, I'm a little worried about how long it takes to freeze. I don't think it's going to lose freshness. It just seems a weak way to do it. You're going to get a lot of drip loss. But maybe it's the best texture-wise, because the people who cook it or par cook it, they beat the ever-loving piss out of it to tenderize it before they serve it, right? And Miss Gulf Coast 19 or Miss Gulf Coast 2014, I don't think she was pounding on that stuff before she made the salad.
No.
No. Yeah, she's skilled at drilling it, I thought. Anyway, so the question for you then is, you can go traditional Caribbean style. Remember, it's a different conch from the queen conch, and I don't know whether it's going to taste sweeter or less sweet. Make sure you clean off all the goop. When I eat whelks in Cape Cod, I eat the whole damn thing. I just boil them, rip them out, grab the operculum, shove the whole, maybe peel a little bit of the stuff off, and they can have a little bit of that, yeah, that grew up at the bottom of the ocean taste. You know what I'm saying? Whereas I think if you go through the trouble cleaning it all, it should be a relatively clean taste, but I don't know how sweet a horse conch is versus a queen conch. I've had what you buy when you buy conch at a restaurant is queen conch, typically, right? And this is, again, a different genus and has a different diet. So I don't know. Maybe eating snails and crabs makes it taste better. I mean, I don't know. I like snails and crabs more than I like – that's not true. I like a lot of seaweed. I really do. I mean, whatever. Was that an okay answer, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
All right. His second question. Similarly, I can catch iguana, an invasive species in Miami, but I haven't found much more than a few basic recipes or advice on catching and eating them with a cursory web search. Any tips on determining if it's safe to eat? Yes, it is safe to eat. However, iguanas, this is a crap paper. I'm going to read you the thing. Any tips on cooking them? I've never cooked one, but I can still talk about it even with no knowledge. That's what I'm here to do. I have successfully caught and cooked a few fish and lobster from the area, so I'm hoping I can develop a number of recipes with ingredients only from foraging and fishing to have an authentic South Florida dinner for myself and classmates October 19th. Okay. The issue with iguanas and reptiles in general are that's going to be parasites, right? That's the issue, is going to be parasites. So here is a garbage paper. The Biological Risks of Eating Reptiles, February 10th, 2010, the source, the Spanish Foundation for Science and Technology summary. Reptiles are bred in captivity primarily for their skins, but some restaurants and population groups also want them for their meat. A study shows that eating these animals can have side effects that call into question the wisdom of eating this delicacy. And then they mention all things that are fixed by normal cooking procedures. Or freezing for parasite procedure. All normal stuff. They're like, may contain trichinosis. So may pork. You know what I mean? Like, although not anymore. But you know what I mean? And then a list of things that ain't nobody ever heard of, but will be killed by cooking. For instance, I'm going to see if any of you know any of these. Pentasomiasis. Nope. Guess what? You're not going to get it, especially if you cook the stuff. This one I appreciate. Nathosomiasis, like with GN, like gnashing of teeth. You don't want it, but you're not going to get it. Sparganosis. No. And these are all theoretical. These are all theoretical things. They also, reptiles have mites on their skin and ticks.
So they didn't, like, get some samples of reptile meat and then culture up these.
Not to the best of my not to the best of my thing. The clearest microbiological risk comes from the possible presence of pathogenic bacteria, especially Salmonella, Shigella, and E. coli, and Yersinia. Okay, like all the other food we eat. It's like people are such jokers. Like, how could anyone in their right mind make this as a recommendation? No, you better hold off. It's got all the same hazards as all the other meat that you eat.
So it's not going to be sushi-grade iguana, is what you're saying?
Well, no, because of the salmonella. However, all the rest of the stuff you can freeze kill. Like all the pathogens, you can freeze kill them. Yeah, yeah. So I was mad about that. And then I read a lot about, I've seen some people, they whole spit roast the iguana. Apparently iguana is a little bit of a pain in the butt to skin until it's been cooked, right? And a lot of there are whole spit roasted iguanas that people eat. I just don't think that's going to be my jam. I mean, I like a whole spit roasted cooey, you know, the guinea pigs.
Yeah.
But a whole roasted iguana, I just don't know that there's going to be enough meat there. I'm also not a frog leg guy just because of the quantity of meat to bone ratio. I mean, I don't mind bones and I like the taste of frog's legs. But when someone says you're going to have frog's legs, I'm not like, oh, yeah. You know what I mean? I'm like, okay. You know what I'm saying? See the difference? Yeah. So anyway, what do you go? Any of you guys huge frog legs people?
Yeah, fried.
Fried, but yeah, but like still, do you like all those bones? You just don't, you don't care?
Eat them if they're fried enough.
What about you, Steph?
Okay.
Okay. But would you seek them out?
No.
Harold?
It depends on how much meat they have on them. I mean, some are really nice and, you know, they've exercised a lot or something. But others are really scrawny and they're not worth it.
You lived in France. Did they actually eat frog legs to a large degree where you were?
No. No, I was in duck country. Much better.
Oh, speaking of, later we're going to get to this. There's a place called the Cajun Kitchen that is selling alligator meat on the internet. And it says, alligator loins, 5 pounds, and put up a picture of a duck breast. And I'm like, I'm not stupid. I know what a duck breast looks like. And sure shooting, I'd rather have a duck breast than an alligator tail, but because duck breast is like, I mean, come on, duck breast? It's up there, above many meats. Okay. Any frog's legs ideas over here on this side of the?
I mean, just some things you have to prepare yourself for, like doing some manual labor.
No, oh, yeah. You know, other thing about frog's legs that I don't enjoy is just the inefficiency of use to whole animal ratio. Mm. You know what I mean? It's not as bad as shark fin, but it's like pretty close. You know what I mean? You cut the leg off, the two legs, and then you throw the rest of the body away. I've seen it like time and time again when people are selling frog's legs. Just cut the legs off, throw the body away. Like still living body. It's just like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, like, look, if you lived in like a lakey, swampy area and you wanted to go out at night with your little frog fork and go frogging, you know what I mean? Because you were going to eat it the next day and your place is overrun with frogs anyway. Yeah, sure, I get it. You know what I mean? But like the practice of raising these relatively large animals specifically just to throw away the greatest mass of their body into a trash can full of like things going bah, 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 with no legs on, it just, I don't get it. I really don't. Anyway, back to iguanas. So the problem with iguanas, aside from the relative boniness, apparently they can taste very bad or not. So there was a lady, also from Florida, who won some sort of contest for making iguana carnitas. And she, I think, just threw the stuff in a slow cooker and then picked it apart and then did it. And served it. She didn't even taste it, which is, I don't even know why they wrote the article about this person. She didn't even taste it. Her 11-year-old tasted it. But she said something very interesting. She said the smell was terrible and that she wouldn't cook it again because it smelled up her kitchen. And a lot of the traditional recipes that I looked at perform a traditional technique for many game birds going all the way back to Roman times and before. And that is a quick boil in water before the roast. And so I'm guessing that there might be some, let's say, off-putting stuff in the skin or areas around there. So I would say do the old school, which is a relatively quick boil, throw that water away, skin it after it's been parboiled, then shred her up, fry the meat, and I've seen people eat it that way on the internet, and they were happy. And what do you think? What do you think about those old Roman techniques? Parboiling. In Apicius, the recipes look terrible because it looks like they're just boiling the piss out of everything and then overcooking the hell out of it. And I ran some tests. If you're dealing with, like, gamier meats, I can see it. Even, like, you know, a lot of modern kind of hunting cooking manuals have the kind of pre-poach out. And a lot of people who are doing bone stocks now do, like, the low bring-up skim to get rid of that initial kind of bleep.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a more assertive pre-soak. I mean, yeah. It's like brains or sweetbreads, usually.
You still eat brains?
I have.
I mean, like...
I mean, I don't, like, seek out calf's brains, but... We were doing stuff with lamb's brains in Copenhagen.
Yeah, I don't eat brains anymore. It's just too much is going to go wrong. It's just a matter of time. Like it's just a matter of time before we all go kind of scrapey mad cow, like
Jakob.
Some sort of Jakob's Creutzfeldt variant, some sort of wasting disease. You know what I mean? Like, it's really just a matter of time for sure. Yeah, yeah.
But they're so creamy.
I mean, I like brains. You know, I don't eat them anymore. I still eat marrow, and I guess that probably also has similar issues, huh? I mean, marrow's good, right? Harold, if someone said to you, you have to give up either marrow or brains, what would you give up?
I'd give up marrow.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Because marrow is, it just doesn't have the delicacy, the range of flavors, marrow can so easily just kind of fall apart into fat.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, so.
But then are you giving up all stocks and all related marrow-related products?
Oh, that's a different, now that's a different story, but.
Okay, so then let's have this discussion. How much, in other words, marrow being primarily a fat-based vehicle, how much do you think the stock is actually benefiting from the marrow itself? And how much is it just that the marrow happens to be there?
No, I think its contribution is probably pretty minimal. But if giving up marrow meant having to give up anything cooked with bones like stocks, then I wouldn't make that trade.
I see. Huh. What about you guys? You guys brain aficionados over here? Well, you already said you like them, but...
I like them. I just don't eat them that often.
Yeah.
I definitely eat marrow more often than I eat brains.
Do you know what? Like, marrow on toast? I mean, marrow on toast? Like, crusty toast? Marrow?
Yeah.
Real good. That preparation alone, better than any brain preparation I've ever had. How do you like your brains? With eggs?
No. I mean, just, you know, slowly roasted in brown butter. With toast or something on the side? I mean,
toast is good. Yeah. Everyone like some people can't have toast. I don't know anyone that doesn't like it. You know?
Yeah.
I told you. Didn't I tell you when I was in Iceland a couple of weeks ago, they served me the split lamb's head without the brain in it. They pre-removed the brain.
Yeah.
They didn't leave it up to me to make that choice. And I have to say, although theoretically I'm angry at them for it, secretly I'm happy because I didn't then have to not eat something.
Yes.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I did finish the question. Right?
We have a question from the chat.
All right, chat, what do you got?
R. Lee 32 asks, any thoughts on using preparative liquid chromatography for flavor isolation? Any chefs doing this?
Ariel?
I don't know of any chefs doing this. I mean, it's possible that, like, the cooking lab in Bellevue has one. I mean, definitely it's something I've thought about a lot and been interested in trying. Like, the big roadblock would be solvents. Most of the solvents that are really good for doing liquid chromatography are super nasty. So I would avoid getting anywhere near, like, hexane or acetonitrile if you're a chef in the kitchen, unless you have a lot of knowledge about how to remove it well.
So pot smokers often do extraction with very toxic things and then have you consume them. is it just because they're doing something illegal anyway and they assume it's unhealthy? Or, like, what are your thoughts
on that? Well, I don't know. I mean, now with like, legal cannabis in so many states, there are a lot of state-level regulations about removing and testing for solvents, I believe. So, like, you know, your buddy down the block, maybe he has some method for, like, removing all the hexane, but certainly if you go to, like, Colorado or Massachusetts, they are going, or they should be, removing and testing for these things.
I wanted to do, like, solvent, because I can't, like, have the supercriticals become reasonably priced yet? Can I get a supercritical CO2 extractor for that won't blow up and kill my crew?
Oh, to buy? So, I know definitely people are getting more into supercritical extraction, which is a totally different process.
Because it's clean.
Liquid chromatography.
Right, right. I was going to do butane.
So with liquid chromatography, you have basically tiny, tiny, tiny beads that are, like, sticky to organic molecules. And you, like, load a column of these with, like, your plant material, and you push organic solvent through. And all the different flavor and other molecules stick to the solids at different rates and come out in a separated way. Whereas supercritical extraction, you use carbon dioxide under, like, extreme pressure. So that actually acts as a, like, semi-liquid, semi-gaseous solvent, and you can tune the polarity of it based on, like, the pressure and the temperature.
Right, but I mean, I don't think the chromatography, I mean, just a first blush,
well,
I don't think it's going
to
work because the yield's going
to,
yeah, the yield's going to be way too low, right? But if you're talking about stuff that has bad solvents, I mean, for
someone... Well, you're going to, I mean, for, like, liquid chromatography, you have to use, like, a huge amount of solvent to get a separation.
Right.
Yeah, because I mean, the stuff you're trying to get off moves at a fraction of the rate of the stuff you're pouring on, so you'd be using, like, liters and liters and liters to get tiny amounts.
To get tiny amounts.
Maybe only need tiny amounts if you're just trying to get, like, you know, natural eugenol from cloves.
But, I mean, you should buy that crap. I mean,
so this is the thing. If you're talking about chromatographic separations, most of the stuff you could buy from a flavor house is isolated that way. So, like, if you're talking about getting molecules, methyl chavacol from basil from Firmenich is not going to be a different molecule than the one that you would get by doing that chromatography yourself.
Right.
So it's just for, like, bragging points.
Yes. In other words, like, that's why I hooked more on the idea of solvents, because solvents is something that I've wanted to use and don't because of the kind of you're using solvents.
Well, and even, I mean, like, the flavor and fragrance industry is moving as much as possible towards, like, so-called green solvents now, too. So they're trying to reduce the use of, like, hexane and other organic solvents and moving towards, like, water and microwaves and supercritical extraction.
Right, but has anyone... So back to my other question, has anyone made a reasonably priced, safe, supercritical CO2?
I mean, like, $20,000?
Not reasonable for me. Call me when you sell it for, I mean, $5,000.
Yeah, if anyone out there knows of one cheaper than that, let us know. But when I've been looking into it, that's the general range
I think
I've seen.
If it was $5,000, a lot of people would buy it. I mean, at $20,000, a pot producer could buy it. Because presumably they're producing pot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that would pay for itself if you're isolating THC.
At my bar, hey, I want to spend $20,000. Why? Because... flavor real fresh, real pure. You know what I mean? Like, I don't see it.
This episode is brought to you by Nourish and Flourish, a handcrafted, independent publication taking readers on a journey from the soil to the stars. Nourish and Flourish showcases thought-provoking stories from around the world and stunning photography. Each issue explores emerging trends in food, nutrition, recipes, soil health, technology, regenerative agriculture, travel, and more. Volume 1 of Nourish and Flourish includes features on the Svalbard Global Seed Bank, the International Symposium on Bread, and ancient Hawaiian aquaculture. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Subscribe today at nourishandflourish.site. For $29.99, you'll receive 3 issues. That's 38% off the retail price. Nourish and Flourish. connecting readers with the people and stories that make a difference in living a more balanced, healthier life. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at nourishandflourish.site.
Aaron writes in, they met us at the Delmonico's dinner, Anastasia. Thanks for your enthusiasm. I'm well on my way to convincing my wife that we should book a trip to the Fruit and Spice Park in Florida. David, I'm glad you're here for this. We have a little research to do to pick the best season to visit. So what are your thoughts on, I know you said you haven't been there in a number of years, but what are your thoughts on the best season in South, in Homes, it's in Homestead, right?
Yes.
In Homestead, Florida, to visit for the widest range of cool. And how do you book a trip there whereby someone will walk around with you and actually allow you to taste things?
You know, I haven't been there for a number of years, so I'm not sure whether, I know they do have festivals held there from time to time. I would go at the same time as the Fairchild Tropical Botanical Garden Mango Festival, which is usually held in the middle of July. Not that, from the point of view of climate, the most salubrious time to visit Florida. Nevertheless, you'll be able to taste mangoes, probably lychees, longan. It's a pretty good time. Plus, it's in the middle of summer, which is convenient for a lot of people to travel.
Like with some of the other stuff that I know that you're not a fan of, I don't know what the bearing season is like. They have a lot of different varieties of Jabotacaba there. Are they ever bearing? What are they?
I'm not sure. In California, I think things are probably different, so I can't remember.
Yeah,
they
have some nice mace. I don't know if that's seasonal. They have a lot of interesting aromatic leaves. They have star fruits. I don't. The thing is, they have such a wide range. Do you remember when we went, Nastasia?
Yeah. Were
we in Harold? We might have gone once during the mango season time, and they also had jackfruits. But it's not like you can eat one of those off the tree anyway. You got to... Has any of you listening ever gotten jackfruit latex on your freaking clothes? Damn. I've still not gotten it out of there. It's jackfruit, right, that has the vicious latex that you have to cut and let skim over after it hits the ground? Am I correct on this? I
think yes. I am.
Yeah. It's nasty. It does not come out of your clothes. Is there an industrial use for that latex?
I don't know. I know that Italian-American teenagers used to tattoo themselves with fig sap, which was sort of, I believe, in the same family.
Huh.
They would inscribe their girlfriend's names on their arms in fig sap.
How long does that last? Infinitely?
I don't think so.
Oh, it's like the henna. So it's not a big commitment.
No.
It's like saying, I like you.
Yes.
It's like, you and me for at least 2 weeks. Right? All right. I can't call on the shows live, but I have two questions. We will be in New Orleans in 2 weeks. Do you have any awesome recommendations? Food and drink are both equally enjoyable for us. Any of you guys been to New Orleans more recently than I have? I went to Dookie Chase's, which is great. Get the shrimp Clemenceau. Get the shrimp Clemenceau. Now, back when Leah Chase was alive, she published several recipes for shrimp Clemenceau. I have made this recipe, and it does not taste like the shrimp Clemenceau they serve at Dookie Chase's. Which leads me to believe she was holding something back in that recipe. Unless, and this is possible, Gulf shrimp are the best tasting shrimp that God has ever created. And no offense, Gulf, or Miss Gulf 2014, I don't think so. You know what I mean? I don't think so. I think they're adding some other stuff. But try their shrimp Clemenceau. Make sure you have a lot of other things to soak up all of the butter, because you're going to want to consume... The star of that isn't necessarily the potatoes or the shrimp. It's the butter. Just like, nom, 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 butter, butter. And then, have their fried chicken, definitely. But also a block from there is Willie Mae's Chicken, which is one of the original traditional, like, Louisiana fried chicken joints. Well worth a visit. If you're going to do muffalettas, you need to have at least two different styles of muffaletta. You need to have both a hot and a cold. Go. I know it's tourist trap. Go to the Central Grocery. Get the traditional muffaletta. I like it. Some people do. Is it you that don't like them, Nastasia? Do you think they're too bready?
It's not me.
Not you? Anyway, and go to Napoleon House to get the hot one. And while you're at Napoleon House, get you a Sazerac or a Pimm's Cup just because it's traditional there. They ruined it like 5-6 years ago when they put air conditioning in. It used to just be a hot box all year round, but it's a good old place. And then if you want to get out to a different neighborhoods, go to, go to Couchon or any one of those nice places out there, right? Right. Also, do you have any experience with low-temp alligator? No! No. It's a pretty crappy meat, right? Maybe not worth bringing home a giant chunk of frozen gator. Okay, so Nastasia Lopez, Piper Christensen, And who else was on that trip with you? Grace.
And Piper's wife.
Yeah. We're in a motorhome in Florida maybe 8 years ago. Yeah, they drove a motorhome all around Florida with a package of frozen gator, and then we had to cook it in the motorhome kitchen, and it has ruined me on gator. First of all, the frozen gator in a plastic thing is like not like a gator steak. It's like just like shredded, nasty gator meat that's been frozen and like kind of weepy thawed, and it was just like, it was unpleasant. Mm-hmm. I've had fried gator plenty of times at like tourist establishments, and you know what it tastes like? Fried. It tastes like fried. Just tastes like fried. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's fried. People are like, it's firm. It's like monkfish. No, it's not. I've had a lot of monkfish. I don't find it bad. In other words, the stuff that Piper bought was garb. It was like just garbage. It's like, but I've had it be fine. But if you locked me in a room and said, what does alligator taste like? I'd say, I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea. You know what I mean? Have you guys had good or bad gator experiences?
Yeah, I've had pretty good roasted gator, but it's always, like, been in a rice dish. It's never been, like in a jambalaya with gator. It's never been, like, a gator steak, like gator tail steak or anything like that.
Right, and so the jambalaya is so highly flavored. What the hell?
There's texture in there, and, I mean, it's not bad, but it's like, chicken-ish.
Was the base, like, did they use a gator stock for liquid?
No.
Right. If you can't make a stock out of it, how good could it be? You know what I mean? Like, chicken stock tastes like chicken stock. Turkey stock tastes like turkey stock, right? I've even made squab stock in bags because it doesn't take as much bones to make a stock in bags, right? Beef stock, good. Veal stock, good. Pork stock can be good if you get rid of some of the initial garbage stuff in it.
Would frog stock be a good use of frog leg waste?
You know, when I think of frog bodies and aroma, all I can think of is formalin-cured frogs, you know, from dissection tables. Or, like, the unpleasant experience I had of harvesting gastrocnemius mussels from frogs for my art projects where I was chloroforming and pithing frogs way back in the day. So I'm having a tough time thinking about the stock. But I would guess the problem with frogs also is that almost all of their musculature is in their legs, and then the inside of their bodies is mainly guts.
Right.
You know what I mean?
People aren't, like, getting excited over gut stock.
Yeah, gut stock
bone broth,
is not...
Bone broth, yes, gut stock.
What?
Bone broth, yes, but...
Yeah, bone broth, which... Okay, broth. You want to have that discussion?
No, I it was a joke about nomenclature, not...
I know, but... Okay.
Not an incitement.
All right.
Just stock.
Here you go. Well, there's a new liquid nitrogen ice cream shop in our neighborhood. They have a very cool liquid nitrogen setup. What's your thoughts on liquid nitrogen ice cream shops?
It's not a bad... So for people who want to do it, I think it's a great business. It can be a great product because obviously you're chilling ice cream super fast. It's probably going to have great texture. But it just depends on where they're getting their ice cream base. If they're getting just run-of-the-mill... you know, not great ice cream base, then, you know, it's probably not going to taste that great. Even the texture might be awesome. And it is because the cost of running that shop labor-wise, they can't churn through customers really fast. They're probably not going to get the best ice cream base. But maybe they are. I can't speak. But, like, if you know if the spectacle's nice and, like, a lot of my friends, their kids like it. So, you know, go check it out. I always say, like, if there's something you want to check out, you should go check it out.
And what kind of freezer do you use?
So we have a Carbajani LB502.
What size is the 502?
Usually we do, like, a 15-quart batch for our batches. And a lot of people call into the show asking where to look for equipment. And there's a website. It's an aggregate called Turnkey Parlor. And they refurbish equipment because, like, there's always ice cream places and yogurt places going out of the business everywhere all over the United States. And they at least provide, like, a 3 to 6 month warranty on most of the stuff that they send back out into the world. And it's a pretty good resource for people who... Because people are always asking, like, where to
pick
up quick. And Turnkey Parlor, they have a website. And they're a pretty good source because they refurb.
So, how much would, like... I don't know if you've looked, but how much is, like, an old LB100?
I mean, they don't make the LB100 anymore. It's not actually that much cheaper than a 502.
Really?
So, yeah, because the countertop LB100, it's nice because it's like a 220. And it's like a 3 to 5 quart batch. I've used a 3 quart maybe.
Yeah, and it's air-cooled.
It's air-cooled, but it's still like $7,000 to $9,000.
Whoa.
And you can get a nice 502. I have a theory about why the 502s are so cheap. Cold Stone, the chain, they were running all of their businesses on 502s for like a decade. And a bunch of them all went out of business. And so there are all these refurb 502s on the market. And they're $12,000, $10,000, $12,000, depending on where you get it refurbed. And, you know, they last 20, 30 years. Like, it's like a stove. I mean, it's a reverse set. Like, there's nothing to break except your belt. And, like, I've replaced the motor on ours before. And, I mean, they just run.
And the refrigeration system's pretty robust?
Yeah, it's 404. And, you know, if you need to get it recharged, it's not super cheap. It's not super expensive either.
And the front doesn't break like the LB100s used to break all the time?
It's all stainless. So it doesn't have the plastic door. It's got a stainless door.
And now, the reason I asked, what's the batch time on that?
Oh, I mean, it's super quick. I mean, as low as 3 minutes and as high as like 9 minutes for a 15-quart batch.
All right, listen very carefully, people. Theoretically, liquid nitrogen is going to give you smaller crystal size. If you have a machine that can do a batch of ice cream in 3 to 9 minutes, your tongue is not an accurate enough texture measuring machine to tell the difference in ice crystal size at that freeze rate in a batch freezer. It just isn't.
The liquid nitrogen, it's a spectacle. It's a nice, people like seeing it, you know, when they go into stores, you know, it's...
What I don't like is the people who are bad at it, who get chunky pieces that are over-frozen. It's not that they're bad, it's just like they need to be tempered out all to one temperature. You know what I'm saying? I find more often than not, I would prefer someone make ice cream, draw it at the correct temperature, and then have it in a dipper case at the correct temperature for serving, and then serve it to me. I find that is when ice cream tastes the best. Am I wrong about this?
No, you're completely right. I mean, it's like serving, but it's another like place where service can fall is where what serving temperature is.
People don't spend enough on their dipper cases?
No, they don't keep track of what's happening in the store. So if there's a big open window, it'll pop the temperature of the dipping case up like 5-10 degrees, or they'll have it running like too cold through part of the day, or like it won't. They'll keep everything in a hardening cabinet overnight, pull it out for service, but the first like 3 hours of service, everything's too cold.
I'm assuming that the most of the dipping case is like you get that big thermal mass from underneath the, like you have like inserts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so like, are they separately refrigerating the top and bottom so that the
No, it's one. It's usually one refrigeration coil that wraps around the whole thing, and they function really well because they're top open, and the air replacement when you open the top isn't as much as like a side open freezer, and they have a lot of mass in there, which helps it keep cool as well. But usually those fillers are just air. It's not there's not like large fillers that take up all the space.
Huh. All right. This actually wasn't what they were asking about. I just, as an aside. I'm sure the folks that work at the LN Ice Cream Shop will eventually be convinced that I deserve to play around with some of their liquid nitrogen. All I have to do is buy enough ice cream to win them over, right? If I were to nitro muddle drinks in their shop, first of all, they're not going to let you nitro muddle drinks in their shop.
If they have any brains, they will not let you touch anything in their shop.
Now, they might sell you some liquid nitrogen to take home in a thermos. But anyway... how long would the herbs last? Assuming I muddled, mixed with booze, and then went home to make the drinks, could the herb-infused liquor last long enough for tasty cocktails in the evening? No. So, I mean, it depends. So, by the way, Nastasia, for your records. Big fan, 36, male, no kids, patient wife who puts up with me spending too much money on cooking equipment.
Yep.
Aaron. Okay. All right. Okay, so here's what it is. Certain herbs are bulletproof, like parsley. Parsley is fine. Parsley doesn't oxidize. Certain herbs, like mint, minutes after you nitro muddle them, they start turning swampy. Something like Thai basil's in the middle. A Thai basil daiquiri batch that's been nitro muddled. So the best thing is, if you're going to save it, is what's called kind of blender muddling, where you freeze. It's a combination. It's nitro blender. Don't just blender it. It gets oxidized. But like freeze like a relatively large quantity of the herb in liquid nitrogen. drain and reserve the liquid nitrogen if you don't have unlimited supplies like I do, put it into the VitaPrep, pulverize it frozen, and if it starts thawing out, add a little more liquid nitrogen, and then add the liquor and the rest of it, briefly pulse to mimic shaking, which is where a lot of the color transfer takes place, is after you pulverize it in the shaking is when you actually get a lot of the color and flavor transfer. Strain so that the herb particles aren't in the drink as you're storing it, and that's the way you can keep the batch the longest, and it can go anywhere from hours for a parsley to about 45 minutes for a Thai basil to about zero for mint. In my opinion, mint is the most fragile. It's like mint and limes are God laughing at us for trying to preserve things. You know what I mean? Because they just don't want to. They don't want to stay. You know. I don't have time to read this right now, Anastasia, because I got. But I'm gonna. I'll read Nick's thing. I'm on zero tasking next week when we're gonna go back for. Oh, having zillions of guests to having probably no guests. I thought it was interesting. Someone asked on the. Twitter whether I was going to do classics in the field this week after I said that we had this all-star guest, and I will, because I have one that, you know, maybe David, you could talk about. Ready? It's time for classics in the field. Yeah. All right, today we're going to be talking about agricultural extensions, the land grant, the Morrill Act, land grant colleges, and a little thing called the Geneva Agricultural Extension, UP Hedrick, and the fruits of New York. Now, those of you that don't know this, you have a relatively exhaustive collection on fruit, correct?
Right, about 2,000 books.
Yeah, which is a lot. As they say, a lot. That's a lot. When I first met you, I mentioned that one of my prized possessions is I have almost the complete Fruits of New York. Now, for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, you're in a little bit of luck. All of them have been put on the internet. They've all been digitized. So in the 1860s, right, actually before, in the 1850s, they tried to get the U.S. government, federal government, to give land to the states so that the states could then sell it and make money, but they needed to establish what's called land-grant colleges to promulgate knowledge to kind of average people, farmers, because this is during the time when agriculture and, in fact, all working professions were becoming more investigated by science. It was more of an idea of education built around trades and practices, right? So Buchanan, being the dumb bastard that he was as a president, did not sign the land grant, the Morrill Act in. Soon, when Abraham Lincoln came into power, he did. It was one of the things that he did during the Civil War, and then after it, most of it took place. Michigan, I think, was the first land grant college that was built, but Cornell not that far behind. Now, these were funded by the states, which means that each individual state did their own thing. And in 1905, the agricultural extension, a guy named S.A. Beach, who was the second head of the horticultural thing there in Geneva, New York is where it was, came out with a two-volume set called The Apples of New York. Now, for those of you that know anything about New York City, New York State, we know apples. We do good apples here. A lot of stuff we don't do that well, but apples, we're good. We're good. And back then, better, right? You know what I mean? So it was, true or false, like, still is one of the top two or three references on apples that's ever been published.
There have been dozens of books, so I'd have to think just what it is that we're talking about, but certainly it's indispensable. It's a linchpin of the lineup of anybody's pomology collection.
And it's gorgeous.
It is. It's a beautiful set.
Now, it's two volumes, and it's relatively small compared to the format of, not in length, because it's two volumes, but in physical dimensions, its length and width is more of a normal book size, not a coffee table book. But it had, for the time, very advanced color plate work and has some of the prettiest pictures in it of any pomological text of that era. Would you agree?
I certainly would, yeah.
Yeah. And now, S.A. Beach, like, I don't know, he wasn't in it for the long haul. He leaves after 1905, and in comes a guy named U.P. Hedrick. You want to talk a little bit about U.P. Hedrick?
Ulysses Prentice Hedrick, who died, I think he was in his 90s in 1951, was one of the greatest pomologists, so much so that one of the orchards in which Andy Mariani and I grow stone fruit in Morgan Hill, California, is named the Hedrick Orchard, our largest orchard, in fact. And he was head of the agricultural station in Geneva for many years, including for six, I believe, of those large... The Apples of New York was an octavo-sized volume, if that means anything to book lovers out there. The main New York Fruits of New York series was a quarto size. They're huge. They're maybe the size of a Manhattan phone book and then some.
Yeah, no one remembers what a phone book looks like, just you and me. And Harold. Yeah, but yes. Yeah.
And they're like 600 pages each. There's the cherries, there's the peaches, there's the grapes.
Small fruit.
The small fruit of New York, the pears of New York.
I've got
them all.
Yeah.
But the rarest were they were followed in the fruits series was started with 1905 with the apples. Most of the rest of them were the plums. We didn't mention the plums. Were from like 1910 to 1922 or something like
Correct.
That. And then there was four volumes of the vegetables of New York, which are much, much rarer to find. They're the beans, the corn, the peas, and the cucurbits, which you have in your hand.
Which I have in my hand, which is, I think, one of the prettiest. Why don't you pass this around, find some choice cucurbits. And first of all, I just love the word cucurbit. I don't even know how it's pronounced. That's how I call it, because I'm singing in my head like old, you know, reggae songs. Cucurbit, cucurbit, cucurbit. Taking over. Anyway, so like the point is that the pictures in this are awesome, and it's also one of those things where they grouped it botanically and not by eating. So cucumbers and melons and pumpkins, all of the cucurbits are handled in the cucurbits of New York. One of the problems with this series, well, it's amazing. They had to go back to get funding from the state legislature, and these documents were put out when they were put out as part of the annual report of the agricultural station. And so they kept on getting into arguments about how much the beach volume, they were produced in a limited number and distributed to people who needed them, like farmers and stakeholders and libraries in New York State. The beach ones were smaller. The S.A. Beach apples in New York came in two volumes and were smaller. But when U.P. Hedrick came on, he started making, as you say, these giant volumes that were quite expensive to produce and I believe were relatively controversial in the state legislature. They were spending all this money on the production of these things. So by the time U.P. Hedrick was retiring in the mid-20s, his understudy, who I think was chafing a little bit, Tapley, right? He is the main author on half of the vegetables of New York, but they hadn't reduced their production value in terms of the pictures, but they'd stopped hard binding them. They're cardboard bound, and they came in these kind of awesome envelopes. The hardest one of these to find is, I believe, it's either peas or beans. I forget which one is easy. If you go to Cornell's website right now, and you go to the Agricultural Extension, they still sell for only, I think, $50 new old stock copies of the corn of New York, the sweet corn of New York, which is also a good find. So you can go buy original from the supplier a copy of one of the vegetables of New York. The rest of the stuff, if you get a perfect, if you were going to collect these, which I recommend, because by the way, not only are the pictures awesome, but like they go through at the time what was an exhaustive discussion of where the fruit came from and how it grows and tastes as grown in New York State. So especially for a New York person, it's like really cool to have. It's very expensive to buy a complete collection. I suggest getting individual books as they come up.
And these vegetables are printed on glossy, higher quality paper, in fact. They're very high quality, but what I was told, and I can't remember who told me this, was many years ago from somebody actually at the station, was that they ran out of money during the Depression. Their vegetables were printed in the 1930s, and ultimately the state legislature said, all right, enough of that, and the series came to an end.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a shame. They were going to keep, I think in the first one of the Vegetables of New York, they write down all of the things that they planned on writing, and then, yeah, they only made four of them. There is a book not written, I think, by the Ag Extension, but funded by the same kind of thing called The Wildflowers of New York. That's an interesting document, but since you can't eat wildflowers, I just don't care about them. I do own it.
Well, I mean, you can eat wildflowers.
I mean, some of them, right? Like what?
What? Which wildflowers?
Well, like tiger lilies, but like, is that considered a wildflower or is that an invasive species?
Beach roses?
Oh, the hips. Yeah, but this is literally the flowers.
Literally the flowers.
How do they taste?
Delicious.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, like a tiny bit bitter, but they have this like amazing, like perfumed rose quality.
It's a nitro model, those.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There are cookbooks of edible flowers. So, yes, there are plenty of...
Dandelions, lavender.
Dandelions. Okay, okay. Dandelion wine, I've had, I've enjoyed. I have just put dandelions in my mouth and gone hump, hump, hump. And I'm not like, you know what? I want to eat that again.
That's
and most
the,
flower books...
The Dave Arnold edibility criteria.
Yeah. Look, it's like mushroom people. Like, they rate it, is it poisonous? Is it edible? Is it choice? I'm going to go ahead and say not choice. You know what I mean?
The cattails, too.
Cattails? But you consider that a flower?
Oh, no. But we're talking about edible wild.
Yeah, but you eat the shoots and roots. This is just flowers. It's not like... This is not like Yule Gibbons. Like, this is wildflowers. Like, flowers. And I've never, I mean, I like nasturtiums, I guess.
There you go.
What other flowers you guys, like, loved? Chai flowers. Garlic flowers. Good, right?
Yeah.
Borage.
Good. Right. But, like, of the flowers that don't come from an otherwise known herb, like, what's a flower where you're like, oh, yeah, mustard flower's good.
Elderflower.
Elderflower. Hmm. What's the deal with elderflower, anyway? Like, is it true that, like, that you can poison yourself off that stuff, or that there's some sort of the berries are poison? What is it? Is it?
With elderberries, I'm not going to get this completely right, but, like, don't ever eat underripe ones, don't eat the twigs, and, like, be very careful about drinking the juice.
I was going to bring my Mayapple in for all you guys to taste. Speaking of
perhaps
poisonous
don't
fruit.
Even drink the juice. There's both, like, an alkaloid and a cyanide issue with elderberries.
But
not elderflowers.
So, I thought there was an elderberry wine.
No, there is, but elderberry wine, when you ferment it, is fine. Some varieties of elderberry juice are fine. There are also, like, public health records of people being poisoned from improperly prepared elderberry juice.
Is it that they're actually picking the wrong stuff?
No, it's the right stuff, but either the wrong time or they're getting... twigs in it, and the wood is not good for you.
Oh, it's the wood?
And the underripe berries.
So, I know we're running out of, in fact, we've run out of time, but one thing, Harold and I separately, when we were at Harvard a couple of weeks ago, whatever it was, mentioned, I was like, we passed by a yew tree, bush, you know, they don't turn into trees here, you know, a yew bush, which for those of you that don't know, what's the genus that's Taxodium? What is it? Anyway, yep.
Texas. I think it's Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. So it has a very, it's not technically, it's what is it when it's not a fruit? An arrol? What is it? It's not a, because it's a conifer. Arrol? Is that what they're called? A little berry-like thing that's not actually a berry because it can't be a berry because it's not on an angiosperm. Anyways, the red thing on the yew. And you can tell when you look at it that it's a yew because it's like a cup-shaped, I'm just going to call it a berry, people. Please don't get mad at me. It's like a cup-shaped berry with a seed on the... Okay, again, don't get mad. With a seed on the inside, right? Okay. And you've all seen these if you've been near an ornamental hedge in the Northeast, all right? Now, deadly poisonous. The seeds, deadly. Like, literally, like, how many seeds, Harold? Like, couple
no
seeds.
No idea, but
deadly.
Not many.
Not many. Like, it's one of those things where you have to warn your kids. I mean, I don't know whether it's oleander poisonous, but it's, like, real poisonous, right? The fruit, not poisonous. And so I'd lived, like, you know, whatever, 47, 48 years without ever tasting one, even though I grew up around them all the time. Harold, you also, and we talked about it, and you had also just recently tasted it.
Yeah, in Cambridge that week.
Yeah, and so, and what are your thoughts?
To me, it didn't taste like much.
Ding. There you go. Edible, not choice. Don't bother. It's not worth the risk of ingesting the seeds.
The haws, on the other hand.
Oh, my God. So I constantly make fun of the Harvard students every time I go because there's all these cool plants to forage from. And Harold and I stayed at a place called the Sheraton Commander near where, George Washington took command of the troops during the Revolutionary War. And as we walk to class every year for the past, I don't know, 9 years, Stas, you've tried it. I think you like it too. We pass this haw tree, and this year, the Haws are always kind of okay. They're real seedy, but they're high acid, punched, almost like a rose hippie taste, wouldn't you say? But yeah. Like juicier?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This year, the Haws were out of this world fantastic.
Yeah.
Amazing. The best Haw on that tree.
Big and juicy and aromatic and...
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And hanging right there. I mean, often in the past, we've had to jump to, you know, get a couple of not so very good ones. These were right there.
Yeah, and I noticed, and I was very happy to see this, that on the science building is where the lectures happen. It's called the science building. Good, nice name. Anyway, so you go into it, and right outside of it are a bunch of staghorn sumacs. A bunch. And every year, I would go... eat some of the staghorn sumac on my way in, be chewing on it, go in, and casually remark to anyone that would listen, why don't you idiots use this staghorn sumac to make drinks? And this year somebody did. When I walked there, they had harvested all of the low-hanging staghorn sumac things. And so if any of you live in a place that has sumacs, it's a little late. It's late in the year now. It's too late. Next year. You know, when they get nice and red, please harvest them. Please, like, boil them, you know, into a tea. Make tea with it. Serve it as an alcoholic or non-alcoholic. You know, it's an amazing color. It's an amazing kind of acidic taste. It grows everywhere. It's free. And everyone has to do their part to get rid of the idea that it's poisonous. Because everyone thinks of the word poison sumac. They're unrelated. Do you know how many sumac trees? I've seen innumerable, like biblically innumerable sumacs, specifically where I am mostly staghorn, in my life. I can count on zero fingers. I would require zero hands to count the number of poison sumac trees, bushes, whatever they are, in the Northeast that I've ever seen. And if it's got a red berry... it's not poison sumac. All of those toxidendrin, whatever in the hell those urushiol, like doped poison oak, poison sumac. No one's like, I'm afraid of an oak tree because of poison oak. But sumac, because no one's living with sumacs, they freak out. If it's got a white berry, stay the hell away from it. If it's got a red berry, please harvest it and turn it into tea. What do you guys got? Any last?
Before you guys head out, I just want to get one plug in for the Heritage Gala. It's on Monday, November 11th, and if you go to heritageradionetwork.org/gala, you can take advantage of early bird tickets, which are only on sale for the next little over a week. So, yeah, you guys should hang out. Dave and Stassi were there last year, and it was a good time. We got to get off the air.
Aw, man. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming in. Hope you guys had a good time. I did.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cooking Ages. Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.